Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 3rd of March. Since 1976, the Antarctic Search for Meteorites program, funded by the Office of Polar Programs of the National Science Foundation, has recovered more than 10,000 specimens from meteorite stranding surfaces along the Transantarctic Mountains. These are the only reliable continuous source of new non-microscopic extraterrestrial material, and they continue to be until we go to some other planets to get some samples and come on home again. Our guest this hour has for a long time now been searching for meteorites. He is Dr. Ralph Harvey, Associate Professor of Geology at Case Western Reserve University, and is the principal investigator for the Antarctic Search for Meteorites. He was the principal investigator of the 2008-09 exploration, and he has been going on these explorations for quite a few years now. You can actually volunteer, I guess, to go on one of these, but I don't know. They say that, you know, you have to think about it for a minute. If you want to really freeze your rear end off, live in a tent for 45 days with no contact to the outside world, no warm bathrooms, no showers, no web surfing, and no cable. If you fail that test, then you probably can't go on this. But our guest has done 19 of these journeys to the icy continent and has collected a number of meteorites. We'll talk about why they go there and what they've been able to learn about other planets and about our planet as well as a result of these kinds of searches. And actually, they've been going on for a long, long time, not just since 1976. We welcome phone calls for Dr. Harvey. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or send an email if you'd like. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. Ralph Harvey, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be there.
What a journey this is, huh? You really go out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, well, it's not not any worse than stepping out of doors in Wisconsin a lot of the winter. So,
I guess so. How long have these been searches? Actually, they've been going on for a long period of time. People have been finding meteorites since the early 1900s, haven't they?
Yeah, the first meteorites found in Antarctica, the very first one was 1912, and some of the very earliest explorers just stumbled across it in the middle of nowhere on the East Antarctic ice sheet, picked it up, and they really didn't think much of it because, of course, meteorites are a curiosity that can kind of fall anywhere on the Earth, and inevitably, as you're exploring some place for the very first time, you might stumble on a rock or two that's out of place. Then again, when exploration in Antarctica picked up more seriously around 1960, several more meteorites were found dotted across the continent. And, you know, it's important to remember this is Antarctica is a continent in its own right. It's as big as the 48 states and Mexico combined. So, again, you expect you're going to stumble on one here or there. Finding them in a concentration, however, we had to wait until 1969 when some Japanese glaciologists were crossing an area of exposed blue ice, which is ice from deeper in the ice sheet that had been all the lighter snow had been blown off it by some of the fierce winds. They normally would avoid that kind of area, but these folks decided to go across it, take a shortcut. And they stumbled on nine meteorites, kind of out on this blue ice. And even then, they thought maybe this is just nine pieces of one big thing that fell. But within a year or two, as they had looked at them, they discovered that amongst those nine specimens were at least five different classes of kinds of meteorites that there's no way they would have fallen together. And the idea that there must be some kind of concentration mechanism that was preserving or hoarding or putting a whole bunch of meteorites together was born. So the Japanese, historically, it's kind of interesting to look back. It's not clear who figured out the concentration was there. I know my predecessor in the U.S. program, Bill Cassidy, was definitely one of those. He describes it as quite a eureka event for himself. And I know he went running to the Japanese and said, "Oh, you don't know what you've got." And they looked at him and, you know, he says he couldn't tell from their eyes whether they knew or not.
Oh my.
But the Japanese did figure it out quite quickly. And in 1974, they went back and found a bunch more. And then 75, a whole bunch more.
Mm.
And by about 1976, they had over 600 meteorites.
Huh.
And meanwhile, my predecessor, Bill Cassidy, who obviously had figured this out as well, he was asking for support from the U.S. Antarctic Research Program. And they kept saying, "No, you can't find anything there. There's nothing there." And, you know, finally, after the Japanese had picked up about 600 or 700, they said, "Okay, we'll give it a try." And so the first U.S. expedition took place in 1976, and we've gone back virtually every year since. There's only been one year we did not have an expedition, and that was due to some bad radio capabilities during a solar maximum back in back in the late 80s.
And the reason you would go to Antarctica rather than, I don't know, the beaches on of Big Sur in California or wherever is because why?
Yeah, I like the idea of the Bermuda search for meteorites. That would go over real well right now. It's about 10 degrees out here.
Where are you?
Cleveland.
Oh, you're in Cleveland. Yeah, you're right. It would go over.
Anyway, there are a couple of good reasons for Antarctica to be such a great treasure trove. The first is the kind of obvious one, that if you want to find stuff that falls from space, lay out a big white sheet. Mm. And Antarctica is a big white sheet, 3,000 miles across. Pretty much anything you find out in the middle of that ice sheet had to fall from space, if it's a rock or whatever it is, and so that makes it very helpful. And that same principle applies, you know, in the deserts of North Africa or the southwest of the U.S. Anywhere you have very little input of new Earth rocks, the extraterrestrial component, stuff falling from space, gets accentuated. And if the background is something that looks very different than a meteorite, then you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
But in Antarctica, we've got something more subtle that's going on that's actually the most powerful mechanism of concentration. The ice sheet itself is growing yearly and daily as snow falls, and that snow packs down and turns into ice. And the ice flows out toward the coastline under its own weight, and this can take millions of years. In many places, or most places in Antarctica, that ice works its way to the coast and then breaks off as icebergs and sails away. And any of the meteorites that have been sprinkled throughout that volume of ice over, you know, millions of years, over thousands and thousands of square miles, most of them are lost that way. Most of them go out to sea, and as the iceberg melts, they're gone. And they're not very concentrated. You know, you'd have to go through many, many, many cubic kilometers of ice to find anything extraterrestrial.
Hmm.
But Antarctica is a big place, and in a couple of places in particular where mountains are holding back the flow of that ice, the ice may find itself slowed down, and it may find itself actually trapped in the mountainous equivalent of cul-de-sacs, where the ice flows in flows in and can't flow out, or can flow out only incredibly slowly. And when that happens, the loss mechanisms for snow and ice in Antarctica become more important. Antarctica is very, very dry air, very, very cold air, and very, very high, fast winds. So that erodes away the surface of the ice sheet, and as that ice and snow evaporates and abrades away, the little meteorites that were sprinkled within that ice end up working their way to the top. And this can happen at a pretty good rate. We've measured in some of these areas, we call them blue ice areas because, again, we're seeing this deep glacial ice with all the bubbles pressed out of it. So it doesn't look like snow or, you know, the ice on a lake. This is really very blue.
Mm.
We go to these blue ice areas, and if you stick a pole in the ground and mark it on a day that's, you know, warm by Antarctic standards, let's say it's only 10 below, and it's sunny 24 hours, you might see that ice surface a blade away, basically evaporating into the atmosphere as much as a few centimeters a day. And so the average might be only 5 or 10 centimeters over a given year. But you got to remember, this has been going on for the better part of a couple of million years.
Oh, my gosh.
So little meteorites, one by one, work their way to the surface. And, you know, you may be losing a cubic kilometer or so of ice every couple of hundred years on a given blue ice area. But if that goes on for, you know, a million years, you can end up with a very significant deposit of meteorites.
Isn't that something?
And
when,
yeah.
And when you find one, I know that you find out how big it is, and also its possible classification. What does that mean? Does that include where you think it might have come from? Or
yeah, to a certain point. I mean, the study of meteorites is it's a very young science. Mm-hmm. We've known for hundreds of years that meteorites are rocks from space, but the fact that so few of them were available until the Antarctic stuff happened meant that we were kind of frozen. Well, a good analogy, frozen, I guess, yeah. I told a pun.
I guess you did.
Yeah, the a good analogy would be that meteorite studies are kind of where biology was in the pre-Darwin era. You know, lots and lots of specimens were being collected as we explore for the first time, but we're still just trying to fill in all the gaps, all the missing links. We have, right now, somewhere on the order of, I'd guess, about 50,000 specimens. But, of course, a lot of them come from very common categories, and we're still finding new rocks that no one had seen anything like it before. And we're very much in a phase where we're still cataloging them. But, you know, we haven't gotten to the point where we can always tie them together and understand how one rock differs from another. We're still finding, you know, the meteorite equivalent of platypuses and zebras and and things, and trying to understand the ties between them, the ways that they're the same and the ways that they're different. That's a big part of the science right now.
Mm. And ultimately, what does it teach us about, I mean, it's kind of a big question, so take it wherever you want. What does it tell us about our solar system? What does it tell us about us to examine these? What have you learned about
both? Well, one of the very first things we learned about meteorites came when we started to understand the techniques required to figure out how old they are, frankly. It's the same techniques that we use to tell how old Earth rocks are, radioisotopes and other complicated bits of chemistry. Early on in sort of the 1950s time frame, as people were trying to come to terms with geochemical traces of the age of the Earth, a few people said, well, let's try a meteorite and see what we get. And what they got was startling, that most of the meteorites they were finding were by far the oldest rocks anybody could find. And they were showing ages of about 4.5 billion years.
Yeah.
We now know from that work and other chemical work that shows how similar many of these meteorites are to the composition of the sun, that your average meteorite that falls from the sky is basically some of the leftover stuff from which the whole solar system was made. What we're looking at is kind of the bricks and mortar, if you will, that came together to create the planets and to create the sun, and it's really the oldest stuff that you can find. In some sense, science is always about finding the origins of things and understanding where things came from. Well, there's no older starting point for our solar system than meteorites.
Hmm.
Now, a very small smattering of those meteorites are a little bit more evolved. They show some; they've undergone some processes that are more typical of a larger body that's trying to be a planet. And in fact, some of the meteorites we have come from the Moon and from Mars. So they're almost planetary in their own right, and we can use them to tell us something about those processes. But 90% of the meteorites that have been found are date from this very earliest part of the solar system's history. And in fact, they are the oldest things that we've found. It's how we date the, it's how we put a time on the origin of the solar system. Mm.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest is Dr. Ralph Harvey, Associate Professor of Geology at Case Western Reserve University and Principal Investigator of the Antarctic Search for Meteorites. He's been leading these expeditions of the Atlantic Search for Meteorites for, he's just completed his 19th journey to the continent, and he led a team of six other explorers in search of meteorites. We're talking about what they have found, why they go there, and all of that, and take your questions wherever you'd like. We have a couple lines open. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Dr. Harvey, and let's start with Buck from Madison. Hello, Buck.
I am so honored. Well, last hour and this are superb, and I was born in Alaska, so I love winter.
Really? You were born in Alaska?
In Fairbanks, yeah.
Ah.
Where we could play baseball at night. But I was too young to attend to the rules of the game. So, Dr. Harvey, I want to dislodge you slightly out of our solar system into impacts even from beyond the Oort sphere that have splashed down or hit us and have deranged history. And do those things show up? We've got chevrons in Madagascar, right? Do fragments of this kind of impact show up in Antarctica?
As you mentioned, that's a very wide-ranging topic. So I'm gonna you're trying to pull me off, but I'll try and narrow it down to something I actually know. How's that? If you're talking about stuff knocked off of craters on the Earth, debris from them that end up in Antarctica, in fact, it's not something that had been seen until pretty recently. We have found in layers in the ice, in both ice cores and exposed in these blue ice areas, a couple of what we'll call spheral beds, which are melted extraterrestrial rock that appears to have been basically the remnants of the fiery plunge of a meteorite through the Earth's atmosphere. And that material forms kind of a layer of little bitty, looks like bowling balls under a microscope. And we found one of those in 98, and recently some French researchers found a bunch more, about four or five more layers in an ice core. But that stuff's really just what we call spallation debris. It's the stuff to come off a meteorite that went shooting past and landed somewhere else. Another thing that's happened recently is that some Italian researchers have found mixed in with the soils of Antarctica on the tops of some distant mountains just poking up through the ice sheet. They've found a geologist would call microtektites, and that is something that originated on Earth but was then knocked basically into almost ballistic paths by an impact somewhere. These seem to be very chemically similar to a group of tektites called the Australasian tektites, which date back about 720,000 years. And those are very common to find, in gem shows and stuff. The Australasian tektites are one of the best-known groups. So this Italian group has found just tiny, tiny little pieces of that stuff, at least they think it's that stuff, in Antarctica. Does that answer part of your question?
It does. Antarctica is clearly a template we should preserve and not trash it by mining so that we can find the stuff that the rest of the world dumped on it, right?
Well, Antarctica, you'll often hear people saying Antarctica ought to be a, world park. But the truth is it already is. The Antarctic Treaty, which was put together in the early 60s has been a tremendous thing. It's one of the few international treaties I know of signed by hundreds of nations and still in force, you know, after almost 50 years. And it protects Antarctica from any kind of commercial exploitation. And it's been very effective. You know, there have been nations that have put claims on Antarctica and would like to treat it like a territory. The treaty basically says you can make any claim you want as long as you don't try and enforce it, and as long as you don't try and do anything commercial or military with it. And so Antarctica has some protections in place already. In the last about 10 years, there have been some more wide-reaching ecological protections going into place, making it much clearer what cannot be done with life forms, well, how many permits you need if you want to touch a penguin, for instance. It's pretty incredible. The only place that those threats seem to... to me, and I'm not a biologist by any means, but the one place I think those protections really don't seem to have gone far enough is offshore of Antarctica. The Southern Ocean is a very big, wild place, but it's like so many of our oceans, it's being fished to an amazing point to where the Antarctic cod, for example, which is a big old fish, about 80 pounds often, and has antifreeze for blood. It's an amazing, amazing creature. Is being fished commercially now, and some of the researchers who study those fish, who used to be able to find one or two to study every year, you know, within minutes of putting a hook down with a little bait, now they can't catch any that are not juveniles. And so there's some fear, particularly amongst those studying life on the coasts of Antarctica and the oceans around it, that the protections simply haven't gone far enough. And in fact, some people are saying that the seas right around Antarctica, like the Ross Sea and the Weddell Sea, are the last remaining untouched seas, and there's great danger that they will be exploited. But in terms of minerals, in terms of, the obvious biological sites, places where there are seals, places where there are penguins, et cetera, the continent has deservedly been well protected, and it may not be perfectly protected, but it's we seem to be internationally cooperating and doing a reasonably good job.
Before I depart, may I ask you to speak on the underground rivers and whether they're older than the Kickapoo River in Wisconsin?
I don't know how old the Kickapoo is, but I can tell you that whenever you have a big sheet of ice, it creates a lot of pressure as you get toward the base of that. And, of course, the Earth itself is heated from within and is trying to lose that heat. So in a place like Antarctica, any place you have an ice cap, actually, you've got heat trying to escape. You've got a big insulating blanket of ice. And no matter how cold that ice is, it's under a lot of pressure at its base. And ice is a very strange substance. It's not intuitive, but ice is a substance that, as you put it under more pressure, instead of resisting melting, it actually gets easier to melt. And the result is that at the base of any thick sheet of ice, you expect some melting. In Antarctica, we didn't know that was really going on. We suspected it had to be because of the physics of the thing, but we didn't know it was going on until some very sensitive studies of the surface of the ice sheet showed some amazingly flat areas where the ice sheet ought to have been kind of rumpled. And quickly we figured out that meant that there was that part of the ice sheet, even where it's, you know, 4,000 meters thick, was kind of floating. And since then, more detailed studies have shown that there are quite a few interconnected lakes under that ice sheet. It's nothing more than the base of the ice sheet melting under pressure with, you know, help from the warmth from below. It's a huge, huge unknown as to how much of that water is getting out into the Southern Ocean. And it's really, really important for the climate models that everybody care so much about with climate change and global warming. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you got a piece of ice that's 2 miles thick and as big as the U.S. and Mexico combined, and you don't know how much of it is melting now, how are you going to understand how much of it's melting 20 years from now? Right. And how it might affect everything. So it's a huge area for study. It's very, very high priority study. And unfortunately, it's one that's technologically extremely difficult. Mm. We have yet to drill into, through the ice sheet, to any of those lakes. Not so much because we can't. It's because we can't do it and preserve the potential biology we might find there. We might find interesting you know, bacteria or other organisms that have been isolated for, you know, 30 million years mm. from the surrounding world. So they're holding back. But, yeah, it's they're there. And, you know, volume-wise, it's going to make the Kickapoo look like a little stream running off your boots.
Thanks, Buck. Always a pleasure to hear from you, sir.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thanks for the call. Tell me, before we take more phone calls, we're flooded with them, about the process of doing these journeys. These are long journeys, aren't they? And when you talk about the high, fast winds, you've got whiteout conditions here. I'm just interested in how you get to where you're going and why it's 45 days and what happens when you can't tell what's up and down and because you're in a whiteout.
Yeah, I can tell you a lot of interesting stories.
I imagine.
Anecdotes, anyway. But the general trip begins around Thanksgiving. We're heading down to Antarctica for the austral summer. So that's the opposite of our northern summers. And so around Thanksgiving, my group will gather in Los Angeles, California. From there, we will fly to Christchurch, New Zealand, where the U.S. Antarctic Program has the equivalent of a little base, and cooperatively with the New Zealand government, and the Italians fly out of there as well. From there, we'll fly on usually a military aircraft down to McMurdo Station in Antarctica, which is on Ross Island. And so by the time we leave the States and we get to Ross Island, we've pretty much been on airplanes of every different sort for about 24 hours. McMurdo Station is the equivalent of a town of about 1,500 people. You know, it's part university because of all the researchers there, part, you know, lumber camp because it's so much work going on there in terms of moving stuff around by truck and, you know, keeping things warm and keeping supplies going. And it's part government outpost, frankly. It's the U.S.'s little town in Antarctica that shows the flag a little bit. Hmm. While we're there, we tap into the stores of material that have been brought down by ship in the previous year to get together some food. That's where we store our snowmobiles and tents and all the other camping gear we basically need. And then we'll take 20,000 pounds of that stuff, put it on an airplane, and fly it out into God knows where and hope there's a place to land. And when we do our research ahead of time, of course. We look at aerial photographs and satellite images and stuff. So, the main part of our job in some sense is to figure out where to go, where the meteorites might be. But once we get out there, it becomes a very, very simple process of staying alive and staying warm and having human eyeballs looking at any rocks we can find.
Yeah, that sounds real simple. Right. Staying alive. It's really, really cold. You can't see where you're going. And,
I don't want to downplay the potential discomfort, but
right.
I have to say that, you know, personally, I'm kind of a wimp in terms of travel. When I go out in the middle of nowhere in Antarctica, all I have to worry about is not falling in a crevasse and staying warm. You know, the people I think that really brave it are people that go into the Amazon jungle and where they have to shake snakes out of their boots every morning. And, you know, there are people throwing spears at them or, you know, I don't have to, and they don't speak your language. I don't have to deal with any of that. I just have to stay warm.
Right.
And almost all of the challenges of Antarctic field work have to do with taking care of yourself. You don't have to worry about crevasses jumping out and getting you. You know, if you get in trouble with stepping in the wrong place, it's because you stepped there, not because somebody else did it to you.
Right. Our next caller is Armando from Galena. Hi, Armando.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
It's kind of cold today a little bit. My question is that I'm sure that if a lot of meteorites fall in the Antarctica, they also fall a little bit everywhere. So they're probably a few feet underground, and through erosion, we might find some. But how do we recognize how does a meteorite look like?
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, the absolute best way to tell a meteorite, whether you're in Antarctica or elsewhere, is the burnt exterior coating that these rocks get as they plunge through the Earth's atmosphere. We call that burnt exterior fusion crust, and it's basically the product of a rock going about 20 kilometers a second, ridiculously fast, brushing up and through and against the Earth's atmosphere. That's a tremendous amount of energy these rocks have in space, and they basically have to drop their velocity relative to the Earth down to zero in a matter of seconds, if not minutes. And so a lot of that energy goes into melting the outer surface of the rock. The rock itself never really gets that hot if it's big enough, because it's been sitting in space at about minus 250 degrees Celsius, about 17 degrees above absolute zero. So the energy of friction of that rock plummeting through the atmosphere basically goes into melting the outer layers of the rock. Most of that just spills away as little droplets. We talked about ablation before. Usually by the time the rock hits the Earth's surface, there's a few millimeters of a black, glassy crust on the outside of the rock. And if that crust is still there, it's pretty diagnostic. There are plenty of things on the Earth's surface that can mimic it, and some rocks are just black to begin with. And I've seen a lot of great fake meteorites where people found a piece of gravel that had gotten rolled around in tar, things like that. But the truth is, if it's got clearly molten outer crust and the inside is very different in color, there's a possibility it's a meteorite. Again, if you're in the wrong place, if you're somewhere where all the rocks are black and shiny, it's quite hard to find them. But if you can find places on the planet where you know the input of terrestrial rocks is quite low, like a desert, most of the rocks that are there are not black and not glossy, you can go out and hunt for them, and that's a pretty big hobby and a pretty big business for a lot of people all around the world. And in fact, the North African deserts are rivaling Antarctica in the number of meteorites they've produced over the last couple of decades for this very reason.
Hmm. Thanks, Armando, for your call. Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
Another fine guest.
Thank you.
May I ask a question as to is it known where meteorites come from? You know, are they from a specific part of the solar system, or do you find that they come from everywhere that's available?
Well, that's a great question. And
may I ask another question, which is, what is the nature of organics that come with them, organic molecules, if there are any? Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
No problem on both of those. Most of the meteorites that we have, the vast majority of them, about 90% of them, we're pretty certain they come from the asteroid belt that orbits between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. And most people are familiar with that from, you know, grade school books as a whole bunch of basically flying rubble. Basically, they're objects, the biggest of which is about 1,000 kilometers across, but there are tens of thousands of objects that are meter scale out there as well. This is an area of the solar system that's been sort of perpetually against the grindstone. And the reason for it is that there really are two big bullies in our solar system in terms of gravity. One is the Sun, and one is Jupiter. And the asteroid belt, not coincidentally, lies right where Jupiter and the Earth would play a tug-of-war on any small body. This is a region of the solar system, in other words, that where the constant tug-of-war, Jupiter one way and the Sun the other way, never really let smaller bodies come together to form something the size of a planet. And in fact, Jupiter and the Sun to this day continually pull those rocks back and forth, forcing them to collide, and basically clearing out lanes within that asteroid belt where the tug of the Sun and Jupiter is particularly bad. These rocks that are kind of bashing each other and grinding together essentially throw debris throughout the solar system. And it's not so much that they shoot them at Earth like bullets, it's that there's a whole cloud of debris in the Earth kind of is tunneling through it. And that's what drives these bits of asteroids toward the Earth. And in fact, it's helped us understand that what we're looking at with meteorites mostly is fragments of these asteroids. There are other direct links as well. We can look at the asteroids spectroscopically through a telescope, looking at how bright they are in different colors and different wavelengths. And we can associate that with different mineral makeups, and we do see that the meteorites match up pretty well with what we can see in the asteroid belt. And in a few cases, they match up really, really well. There's a group of meteorites called the HEDs, stands for Howardite, Eucrite, Diogenite. That's neither here nor there, the naming of them. The point is that they are rocks that have a volcanic heritage. They've been studied quite a bit. And they're when you look at what minerals they're made of, it seems to match up absolutely perfectly with one of the four largest asteroids out there called Vesta. And Vesta's been looked at in detail by the Hubble Space Telescope and by ground-based telescope for years. And it's almost as if from the mineral makeup of Vesta and the comparison to these HED meteorites that there's no other source for them. There are, of course, a lot of meteorites. Well, let me put it another way. That's really the only case for most of the meteorites that we can say, okay, right there, that object I'm pointing at, that's where these meteorites came from. It's more of a general thing for most scientists that, you know, the match between these asteroids and the meteorites is pretty good, so it's probably where they came from. And, you know, we see this mechanism in place that could deliver them, the tug of war between Jupiter and the Sun. That said, astronomers are putting a lot of effort into trying to match up given classifications of meteorites with specific asteroids. And I think one by one, as time goes by, we're going to see that those matches occur. The catch is it's really hard to look at the asteroids. They're very small. We've only had a couple of spacecraft go out to look at them in detail. That's going to change, by the way, real soon. The Dawn mission, which is on its way to the asteroid belt, will orbit the asteroid I talked about, Vesta, for about a year, and then move on to the biggest asteroid, Ceres, and orbit that for a year. And we expect to learn a lot more about these parent bodies of the meteorites that way. There are a smattering of meteorites we know came from the Moon. I mean, we have good ground truth on that. We've been to the Moon and brought rocks back, so when we find a meteorite, we can compare them directly and see that they're the same. And we have a group that we think came from Mars. We're almost certain on that because we've had spacecraft on Mars that could do very sophisticated geochemistry, and the rocks match up really well. There are a lot of people speculating on whether we might have meteorites from Venus or from Mercury. Without ground truth from those planets, though, it's really hard to make that connection. And theoreticians tell us that it's very unlikely we would be able to find any meteorites from things that are outside the asteroid belt, Jupiter, etc. The reason being is that, again, Jupiter is such a big bully that any object that's perturbed enough to come soaring in toward the inner solar system if Jupiter influences at all, or the Sun influences at all, it's likely to make one trip in and then be gone, and either be thrown out from the solar system or be grabbed by Jupiter or the Sun. So we could get hit by that stuff, but it's going to be the one-off chance in a zillion. You know, most of what we're going to hit is the rubble that's being constantly produced by this grinding action in the asteroid belt.
Interesting. Let me ask, maybe just answer that, but what makes a substance, the grinding action in the asteroid belt, what exactly is going on that makes a substance so perturbed that it just leaves and hits us?
Well, I don't want to go into a full astronomy lection here, but that's the year we're in. Basically, we've known for a long time that in any kind of system where objects are orbiting another, and in our case, it's all the objects of the solar system orbiting around the sun, that the period, that is, the amount of time that the planet or planetoid takes to go around the sun is related to its distance in a very clear way. And what that means is, if you're at a given distance from the sun, you're going to have one trip around it, one orbit of it, which we would call a year for that body, is going to take a very specific time. Well, the asteroid belt happens to lie in a place where there are what astronomers call resonances, where a certain asteroid might go around the sun three times in exactly the amount of time Jupiter would go around once. And these you have places in the asteroid belt where an asteroid might go around three times and Jupiter only once. What that means is every 3 years in that asteroid's history, Jupiter is right there pulling it one way and the sun is right there pulling it the other. And it's going to move.
Yeah.
Now, these resonances occupy kind of a very particular space within the solar system. They're almost like grooves in a record. And if you think about a record that's skipping, okay, it's just going over and over again, and you're seeing the movement of that needle jumping from one groove to another all the time. The asteroids kind of are feeling the same thing. They're getting tugged a certain way again and again and again. Mm. And what it means is their little orbit isn't stable.
Mm.
Their little orbit, they're being pushed further in toward the sun or pulled further out. And they're going to bump into the asteroids or bother them or fly by them much more often than they would if they were in stable orbits. And the result is that over 4.5 billion years, what might have originally been kind of a disorganized gravel lot in space has had furrows cut through it by this tugging of Jupiter and the sun. And it mixes everything together, and all of that debris is flung out in the solar system. The very recent study just came out a few days ago, actually, where people tried to model how many asteroids there must have been originally and compared it to what they have today. And, their argument is that the asteroid belt of billions of years ago was maybe 10 times as full of rocks as it is today. And so all of that debris has been flung around. And it actually helps explain something that we see in the inner solar system, which is that the inner planets seem to have been bombarded very heavily by giant impacts back, if you go back 3.8, 3.9 billion years ago. The moon is getting fuller and fuller every night now, so if the audience goes out and looks at the moon and you look at the darker patches of it, those are big impact basins, and all of them seem to come from this time frame of about 3.8, 3.9 billion years ago. And that's the scars that remain from this asteroid belt being sort of stirred up and cleaned out.
Wow. Oh, and that's fascinating. We got to pause for just a moment. We'll look at the moon with whole new eyes tonight. Well, we got to take a pause. We'll return. Dr. Ralph Harvey is our guest, Associate Professor of Geology, Case Western Reserve University, Principal Investigator for the Antarctic Search for Meteorites. He's been the Principal Investigator for some 19 of these remarkable expeditions. Frank, thanks for the call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls, and let's start, go to Mike from Woodstock. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Great topic. I'm afraid my question's not very technical, but my kids and I enjoyed the movie 8 Below Zero, and I was wondering if you had any comments on the movie as far as how accurate it was or if you knew any of the characters in the movie.
That's a great question. I've been asked a few times whether the professor that they have in the movie who's looking for a rock from Mercury, whether that's really me. And it might be. This is a little bit of an anecdote, but back about 10 years, the Disney Corporation put out a little question on the internet saying, yeah, we need to talk to somebody that has good anecdotes about life in Antarctica. And I kind of answered their call and told them what I did and, you know, said if they want any of my help, I'm happy to give it. And they never called me again. And then when the movie 8 Below came out and I saw the scientist was a meteorite hunter, I figured, okay, well, I guess I helped him out somehow.
I guess you did.
Anyway, it's a Disney movie, and it's more about the dogs and the people, and it's less about the science. So I won't go any further than to say that it's a very romanticized version of what we do. Mm. I will say that, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, dogs aren't active in Antarctica anymore. They haven't been for about 20 years. And the reason is that the dogs, which were superb companions for the science and exploration aspects of things, unfortunately could easily pass on diseases like canine distemper to the native seal populations.
Oh.
And pretty nasty thing. And another thing is that happened was if a dog should get loose, you know, none of the animals of Antarctica had any fear of them, and there are a number of cases where a dog or two got loose and could kill literally thousands of penguins in a day.
Oh, my.
Because they don't know any better, you know? It looks like, to them, it looks like it's the best fun ever.
Oh.
So there aren't any more dogs in Antarctica. We don't do it that way. That Disney movie is actually based on a true story, but not an American story. It took place in Japan, and some of the particulars are very accurate. Basically, a Japanese group of glaciologists, again, back in the 60s, that had been traveling with their dogs for a very long time, were forced to leave their dogs behind.
Oh.
And in a very, you know, harsh way, they were left behind basically to fend for themselves or die. And in fact, a couple of them did live the winter. And so that's kind of the ultimate basis of the story. The Japanese made a movie of it, though, that was much sadder. And basically the Japanese movie, instead of, you know, talking about a happy ending, the Japanese version of the movie ends up showing how those scientists' lives just came apart because they had left their best friends to die.
Oh.
And you know, just to spoil your day even more, it's estimated that the couple of dogs that did survive probably did kill somewhere on the order of thousands of penguins and seals.
Oh, my.
You know, not all just to keep themselves alive. Some of it just because they were bored.
Oh, right. My.
Mm. Well, I guess I'll stick with the Disney version.
I think it sounds the one I want to see, too.
I'm trying to live the Disney version myself. That life is a little nicer.
Right, yeah. I think you are living that life. Here's an email. We're running out of time here. This is a fascinating discussion. Have meteorites from outside the solar system ever been found? Pat from Milwaukee.
Short answer is no whole meteorites, but we do see signs in some meteorites of a few tiny little grains of incredibly durable substances, things like diamond and silicon carbide and titanium nitride, that appear to survive from the gases and dusts that were in this neighborhood before our star turned on and kind of heated everything up. So there are signs of true interstellar material hiding inside the meteorites, but it's not something you could ever see by, you know, picking up a rock and looking at it. And certainly no every meteorite we've found so far has been pretty thoroughly integrated or processed during the earliest parts of our solar system, where things were getting stirred up and the planets were coming together and the sun was turning on.
Huh. And believe it or not, we have people who want to volunteer. So do you have a website that they can go to?
There is a website. It's a little out of date, but if you just do a search using Google or whatever for ANSMET, A-N-S-M-E-T, I'm sure you'll find it. And I have a very old-fashioned requirement for volunteers, which is to write me a letter on paper. I've found it.
I like that.
I found it's way too easy for people to dash off an email that would commit them to misery. whereas when I make them put it in paper, it slows people down dramatically.
I think
and be aware that, you know, I give priority to people that are doing, you know, academic research on the meteorites.
Right.
You know, with hundreds of volunteers each year, it's a way to try and help people advance the science. That's, you know, if someone is not in that line of work, there's still possibilities, but, you know, shouldn't expect too much.
Okay, thank you so much. You were just wonderful. Thanks for being with us.
Well, I'm glad to be there.
Yeah, and Dr. Ralph Harvey, Associate Professor of Geology, Case Western Reserve University. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production. Would you love to have this guy as your guide? He loves what he does. We'll be with you again tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.